Drop in your host, Behrouz Najar.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Patiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Death toll from the Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip rises to 228 as a Palestinian woman was killed in the latest airstrike on Khan Yunis. China says a US warship has illegally entered its territorial waters in the South China Sea, undermining regional peace and stability. Also ahead, India's coronavirus fatalities exceed 287,000. As nearly 3,900 more people lost their lives in a single day. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, Israeli forces have conducted new strikes on the Gaza Strip on the 11th day of the regime's aggression against the besieged territory. A woman died and 8 others were wounded after Israeli warplanes targeted a house in Khan Yunis. That brings to 228 the number of Gazans killed since Israel started pounding Gaza on May the 10th. Nearly half of the victims are women and children. So far, over 1,500 Palestinians have also been injured and more than 52,000 displaced. The Israeli Prime Minister has said that the regime has no time frame for ending its onslaught against the Gaza Strip. Benjamin Netanyahu also said that Tel Aviv, quote, does not rule out anything. Breaking news reaching us here, 4 children from one family again have been injured in an Israeli airstrike on a residential building in the besieged Gaza Strip, Gaza City to be more exact. We've seen a pattern of this over the past few days where an entire family is either injured or killed in some instances, in this case injuries, and we'll bring you more on that as well as further Israeli artillery, fresh attacks and warplanes are conducting new attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip in the southern part of the enclave. Palestinian resistance groups, meanwhile, have launched fresh attacks on Israel in retaliation for the regime's deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The Al-Qassam Brigade has fired mortar shells at Nir Oz settlement in Eshkol region, southern Israel. The group also fired rockets into Eshkol, where Israeli media reported casualties without specifying. Rocket sirens also sounded in Zikim and the Nativ HaShara settlements as well as the city of Ashkelon. In the past days, Palestinian resistance groups have also conducted rocket attacks on Tel Aviv. The groups have promised more attacks there if Israel does not stop its airstrikes on Gaza. A dozen Israelis have so far been killed in the Palestinian retaliatory attacks. Fresh protests have been held in several countries against the ongoing deadly Israeli aggression against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Thousands of people in Mauritania took to the streets to denounce the Israeli violence. Tunisian demonstrators also marched through the country's capital to voice their support for Palestinians. Similar rallies were held in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and the southwestern Yemeni city of Taiz. In Kuwait, protesters gathered in Kuwait City and slammed any normalization with the Israeli regime. Kuwaiti political activists at the rally slammed Israel for killing Palestinian women and children.
Protesters have staged a sit-in in Imam Hussein Square of Tehran to show anger at the brutalities of the Israeli regime in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
This year, due to the corona pandemic, we couldn't stage rallies on Quds International Day. So today we are here to support Palestinians and condemn the atrocities of the Zionist regime against them.
Whenever a crime happens in the world, the international bodies release statements and slam it. But they are silent about the brutal acts of Israel in Gaza. I'm here to show solidarity with Palestinians and tell them that they are not alone.
It is our duty to participate in such events. Since the Islamic Revolution, we have participated in all these demonstrations, and right now we are here to support the innocent women and children of Gaza and Palestine.
Waving the flags of Palestine and the resistance movement, they chanted slogans against the global arrogance and the Israeli regime, which has recently begun a new wave of attacks on the besieged Gaza. In their slogans, the demonstrators also announced that they stand with Palestinians and their cause until they achieve victory. The IRGC commander was the speaker of the event, who blasted Israel, saying that this time the situation has changed.
This is the first time that Israel's shipping and aviation industries are disrupted. This is the first time that Israel's capital is being showered by missiles every day. This is the first time that all Zionists are in shelters.
At the end of this gathering, a statement was also read out to wrap up the demands of the Iranians from the international bodies regarding the crimes committed by Israel.
Over 200 people, including women and children, have been killed in recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, while millions of people across the world have taken to the streets to condemn the Israeli aggression. The international bodies are still keeping quiet. Human Abedi, Tehran.
China has accused the U.S. of violating its sovereignty in the South China Sea amid heightened tensions between the two countries. China says an American warship illegally entered its territorial waters. According to the Chinese military, the vessel entered the waters near the Paracel Islands without permission and was followed by its ships and fighter jets. It said the move was aimed at undermining regional peace and stability. On Tuesday, a U.S. warship also sailed through a sensitive waterway between Taiwan and mainland China. Washington has repeatedly carried out drills and missions in the South China Sea, which China describes as interference that is aimed at stoking tensions in the region. Let's bring in Fabrizio Goldoni for more analysis on this. Season analyst and commentator joining us out of Hong Kong. Fabrizio, welcome. What do you make of U.S. warship sailing in Chinese territory and Chinese water? Why is the America provoking another sovereign nation?
I think this one is something is quite dangerous, especially in this moment that we have so much friction around the world, and there are many theaters, war theaters, that are open. But in this particular case, we have to see the frame that what's happened, because Actually, it's already 2 days that basically they are provoking, the U.S. Navy is provoking the China Navy. It happened on Tuesday when the U.S. sent quite an important piece. So it means a missile destroyer called Curtis Wilbur. That is quite an impressive piece of weapon. The point is that when this Navy move in the Taiwan Strait, it is highly contested because before the American Navy seldom transit in this close passage. It normally goes with a lot of other ancillary vessels. It means, for example, submarine, or it means even airplane for detecting submarine. So the point is this, that not only they enter with the fleet in the Taiwan Channel, but after today, now is Thursday, they enter in the district of Paracel Islands. Okay, so now we have the declaration of the Chinese Military Southern Theater Command. So it's something that official has been reported by Reuters, for example, that they clearly specify the entering the waters without any permission. And on top of this one, as I said before, they are followed by planes and other vessels, right, and so on.
You know, Fabrizio, very quickly, if you can, it's not just China where U.S. warships sail through, you know, sends its warships to their territory. Many would be asking what the reaction of, or what the response of the America would be if another country sent one of its naval vessels near the coast of California, for example.
Yes, absolutely. The point is this, the reply is this one. We know that for sure, if something like that happen, there will be immediately a kind of alarm and an exchange, most probably of a fire. You know, there will be the beginning of most probably of a conflict. But apparently, the logic of the double standard work also in this case. Because actually, this U.S. Navy, the fleet is really a few miles from the China coast when they transit the Taiwan Strait. So imagine that if China send their carrier, you know, closer to the USA coast, how trouble it will come out. So it's quite a provocation, you know. Provocation with a double standard mentality in mind. Yeah.
Fabrizio, thank you very much indeed for your time. Fabrizio Goldoni there, analyst and commentator, joining us out of Hong Kong. Now in other news, India has reported more than 276,000 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 and more than 3,800 related deaths in 24 hours. Thursday marks the fourth day in a row that India's daily caseload is under 300,000. India has been ravaged by an aggressive new wave of coronavirus for the past weeks, and most of its states have now gone under a partial or a complete lockdown. The grim situation has caused the severe shortages of hospital beds and oxygen supplies in the South Asian country. The World Health Organization has also warned against the Indian variant of COVID-19 by classifying it as a global concern. The number of total coronavirus cases in India has now surged well past the 25 million mark. Over 287,000 people have lost their lives to the pandemic in India. Manawa Zaman is our correspondent in New Delhi and joins us now. Manawa, so not the numbers of 400,000 infections that we saw earlier this month, but still a very large number of cases.
Well, indeed, it was a large number of cases, but as we anticipated, the second wave of the pandemic was going to be extremely deadly, which the government, and of course, not just the government, of course, the public also felt that the virus is retreating. because if we remember last October, the virus started retreating and the government started being lenient. But this was already anticipated, and the scientists already said that second wave is going to be deadly. But what most important I want to add here is, from the last 1 week, we are seeing a slight downside in the trend of the active cases. And that's because of the fact that the strict lockdown has helped the country to a tremendous extent to control, at least, if the numbers are not coming hugely in ups and downs, but at least they are being controlled to some extent. How we can say the numbers are being controlled to some extent is because of the fact we are seeing a less number of people getting admitted to hospitals. And what we see, the death toll that we see keep mounting on every day, these are those people who were already infected and who were already admitted to the hospital. But the most important aspect that I would like to add here is that it was just the one side that the COVID-19 pandemic was hitting the cities and big metropolis and towns. Now the biggest trouble that the country is facing is, now we're seeing a change in trend. The COVID-19 pandemic is hitting the rural side or the countryside the hardest. And what reports and sources are telling me that there is an utter crisis in the rural parts of the country. Their people don't have hospitals, they don't have healthcare. Most of the people are quarantined under the under the shades of the trees. And of course, the lack of oxygen is also a big crisis and a big challenge there for the government. In fact, when we see the COVID-19 on the peak, there was a lack of oxygen in the cities. So you can imagine what would be the condition with the rural parts of the country. And the reports are also saying that there are tremendous deaths happening in the rural side of the country. And such is the extent of the death and devastation that the bodies, dead bodies, are being dumped into the rivers such as Ganges and Yamuna. What we see yesterday and day before yesterday, the national media, international media, talking about those bodies being cremated on the banks of River Ganga and Yamuna. And that's the biggest trouble. And I presume that the death toll is going to be more than what the government data suggests. Not just I am speculating these data and figures. It's all the health experts, all the scientists, and all the medical people. They say the death toll could be as much higher as 5 times what the government data says. Back to you.
Manawa, thank you very much indeed for that. Manawa Zaman, our correspondent, joining us live from the Indian capital, New Delhi. Now, Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, say significant progress has been made after a fourth round of talks in Vienna, but that key issues remain unresolved. Our correspondent, Homer Lesgi, reports from Vienna.
A fourth round of talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, concludes in Vienna, with delegations headed back home for further consultations. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said there'd been substantial progress in the past 10 days, but there were still issues that needed to be worked on. Mora said he believed an agreement was possible before Iran's presidential elections next month.
I will not venture a date because you never know. But I'm quite sure that there will be a final agreement, yeah, not far from here.
Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said the issues that needed resolution were difficult.
Some delegations believe that the next round could be the last round. I cannot say that definitely, but because we are not there. We are still not there, but I think that if the other side, especially the U.S. side, can make their difficult decisions, we might be able to come to the conclusion next time we meet here in Vienna.
Araghchi said Iran is standing firm on its position that the U.S. needs to fully lift all sanctions in a verifiable manner before Tehran can take action to come back to full compliance with the JCPOA. Reports indicate that though the U.S. has agreed to ease sanctions on various sectors like energy, banking, shipping and insurance, there are still differences on sanctioned individuals and entities, including Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Questions have also been lingering on the fate of Iran's advanced centrifuges and whether the U.S. sanctions will be fully removed or temporarily eased. The sides have decided to meet again next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
And And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The devastating impact of the Israeli regime's bombing raids on the Gaza Strip has been visible on social media for the world to see, with heart-wrenching images and videos of the dead and injured being shared by millions of people, sparking intense fury leading to protests around the globe as marchers in solidarity with the Palestinians have been gathering steam in many major cities. We now present you an article written by Richard Sadan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled Mainstream Media Bias Israel controls the narrative while Palestinians are murdered. The regime's relentless and merciless bombings of Palestine over the last few days is becoming a massacre, the latest one that is inflicted by ruthless colonial Zionism. At the time of writing, reports suggest the death toll in the Gaza Strip alone stands at approximately 192, the vast majority of casualties being civilians, including Palestinian women and children. The number will have likely risen by the time that this article has been broadcast. Hundreds have been injured and tens of thousands more have been rendered homeless by the Israeli regime's latest round of brutal violence. And the Israeli regime, in spite of global revulsion, shows no sign of stopping. It knows exactly what it's doing. It has one of the most sophisticated armed forces in the world, and the carnage is intentional. In addition to the countless fatalities and injuries inflicted, vital infrastructure in Palestine has also been destroyed by Zionist bombs, whilst families in the Gaza Strip remain terrified at the prospect of not knowing where and when the next explosive might land, with nowhere to escape, nowhere to hide, and with no means to withstand the onslaught and protect their families. The devastating impact of the Israeli regime's bombing raids on the Gaza Strip has been visible on social media for the world to see, with heart-wrenching images and videos of the dead and injured being shared by millions of people, sparking intense fury leading to protests around the globe, as marches in solidarity with the Palestinians have been gathering pace in many major cities. But the only thing worse than the continued ongoing support of Israel's murderous regime by most of the international community, their blatant approval or complicity voiced or signaled either through silence or lukewarm, neutral and meaningless statements, is an equally compliant Western mainstream media. One expects to hear the usual redundant platitudes of describing the butchering of Palestinian civilians as clashes, whilst calling for both sides to take steps to secure peace from politicians. It's the norm. But these are the kinds of phrases we're also seeing churned out by media outlets in a 24-hour revolving cycle of lies. It's always been that way, and now it seems as bad as ever. Journalists and news anchors, who in theory are supposed to describe the truth and reality of a situation, are instead presenting the Israeli regime's murderous attacks, the murder of civilians and destruction of Gaza, as a conflict of two sides, hiding under the justification of balance as a reason for doing so. People have rightly called out the British taxpayer-funded BBC for being guilty of this over the last week or so. But in truth, switch on your television at any moment of the day and observe the coverage on nearly all of the Western mainstream media channels about what is happening in the Gaza Strip. You will see a different story being told compared with the disturbing images of the countless Palestinians who have been maimed and killed in recent days, which are being shared all across social media. There is no balance in the so-called conflict between Israeli and Palestinians. And any serious journalist knows this. Israel is illegally occupying Palestine with armed forces and weaponry, which is the most cutting-edge and state-of-the-art equipment. The Palestinians, who have a legal right to resist occupation, barely have an army. It is the politics of another universe to suggest that what the Israeli regime is doing in the Gaza Strip is part of an equal war of two sides. And the reality is, most of the world can see this and knows this, but the mainstream media, which still yield an incredible amount of influence, far from reflecting the truth of the dire situation in Palestine and the Gaza Strip, are actually seeking to control the narrative and present illusions as fact. But this is a grotesque betrayal of the truth. The Zionist regime is not defending itself. The Zionist regime is brutally attacking a defenseless people who are sitting ducks right now as we speak. And of course, we are now learning that Israel's narrative is not just being peddled by a willing Western media. The narrative is also being controlled now with force, as it is being reported that the Israeli regime destroyed the building which housed several media outlets which operated in the Gaza Strip. In much the same way as pro-Palestinian voices are silenced within social media platforms and censored, the Israeli regime's war on truth and the attempt to control the flow of information has led to those platforms in Gaza reporting from within the Gaza Strip being deliberately targeted by the Israeli army. In much the same way as every decent human being should be appalled at Israel's latest attacks on the Palestinians, all right-minded journalists should be appalled at Israel's attempt to prevent the truth of its brutal actions from being reported on from directly within Palestine. But the regime is seriously losing face. Millions more people around the world are joining the growing tide of voices condemning the Israeli regime's behavior and are siding with the Palestinians and they're demanding justice. Despite Israel's bombs, the Israeli regime cannot and will not stop the truth from reaching the world. And far more people reaching the simple conclusion that the Israeli regime is a violent apartheid settler enterprise constantly breaking international law. Vast swathes of global public opinion are now at odds with the continued status quo and are furious at the Israeli regime's ongoing murderous assault and brutalization of Palestinians. They're demanding that it comes to an end right now and that the Israeli regime finally be held accountable for the murder of innocent Palestinians. The Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights says ambiguous positions adopted by international bodies, including the United Nations, on the ongoing massacre of Palestinians by the Israeli army in the Gaza Strip are aimed at legitimizing Tel Aviv's crimes and encouraging their repetition by the occupying regime. In a recent letter to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights called for serious action to stop the Zionist regime's crimes against innocent Palestinians. It said, inviting both parties to the conflict without any condemnation of the child-killing regime, occupying regime, or any reference to the right of legitimate self-defense against the regime, whose very presence in the Palestinian territories is based on usurpation and occupation, cannot only be considered as a step towards legitimizing the crimes of the Zionist regime in Palestine, but also a clear, systematic violation of the right of nations to self-determination. The Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights noted that the United Nations' call for restraint on the part of the parties to an unfair conflict, while the Palestinians' elementary defensive actions are in no way comparable with the crimes of the armed-to-the-teeth Israeli regime, amounts to supporting the occupier, consolidating the occupation of Palestine, continuing aggression, and assisting in aggression in Palestine. It emphasized the constant breach of the basic rights of the Palestinians in the form of acts of aggression by the Zionist regime, including the intensification of genocidal operations, racism, Judaization, illegal settlement activities, forcible eviction of Palestinian families from their land, racial cleansing, and attacks on the Bab al Amud and Sheikh Jarrah neighborhoods of the occupied eastern Al-Quds. The letter by the Iranian Judiciary's High Council for Human Rights also said the criminal Zionists are intensifying their attacks on a daily basis amid an apparently deliberate inaction of international circles and many countries who claim to defend human rights. It added, the silence and inaction of world bodies on such blatant Israeli crimes and the issuance of ambiguous statements which aim to legitimize the Zionist regime's behavior are grounds for encouraging the Israeli regime's crimes. Directly addressing the United Nations chief, the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Council said, while strongly condemning the savage crimes of the Quds occupying regime and indifference or implied consent of some countries and international bodies towards these crimes, the Islamic Republic of Iran's High Council for Human Rights persistently requires you, as the highest-ranking United Nations official, to use all the existing capacities in line with your missions and duties to stop these crimes and bring to justice those who have perpetrated these crimes, stressing that the United Nations Secretary General should recognize the status quo as a situation resulting from the violation of jus cogens and compelling rules of the international law. The Iranian Human Rights Council suggested that the United Nations set up a commission of inquiry or launch a fact-finding mission and use all of its power, including Article 99 of the United Nations Charter, to draw the attention of the UN Security Council to this gross violation of human rights.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter and the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. Egypt, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Soviet Union, yes.
United Kingdom, abstain. The United States, yes. Paraguay, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israeli flag was hoisted outside the United Nations just after this session. When the UN General Assembly voted on the partition plan for Palestine, the Zionists did not keep the great powers waiting. The representative of the Jewish agency at the UN told the members of the Security Council what they were waiting for.
Not later than May 16th next, a provisional Jewish government will commence to function in cooperation with the representatives of the United Nations then in Palestine.
But in the first step, the White House acted against the Zionist expectations.
America, it hurt us.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons: Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should therefore carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. Shortly before this announcement, Eliyahu Epstein, head of the Jewish agency in Washington, wrote to the U.S. president that the Act of Independence would become effective at 1 minute after 6 p.m. on May 14, 1948, Washington time. With full knowledge of the deep bond of sympathy which has existed and has been strengthened over the past 30 years between the government of the United States and the Jewish people of Palestine, I have been authorized by the provisional government of the new state to tender this message and to express the hope that your government will recognize and will welcome Israel into the community of nations.
hours later, just 11 minutes past 6 p.m., Harry Truman wrote to the UN General Assembly despite George Marshall's disagreements.
This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
The Israeli happiness of forming a Jewish homeland on the promised land did not last long. The very next day, when David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence at the Tel Aviv Museum, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, angry with their new uninvited neighbor, attacked Israel. The fledgling Israel had no aircraft nor tanks, and the Arabs were superior against the Zionists in the number of fighters and arms, and their victory seemed certain. The same theory turned into reality. The Arabs achieved significant victories. The Zionists saw with their own eyes that the Jewish homeland was on the edge of destruction. David Ben-Gurion and his companions had to do something, so they went around the world to buy weapons. Finally, Czechoslovakia and Russia sold arms to Israel. The weapons of the Eastern Bloc changed the equation of power on the battlefield. Arabs were optimistic and participated with part of their power in the war, but they were unsuccessful. The UN was under the US pressure to declare a ceasefire to end the Arab-Israeli conflict and pressured the Arabs to sign a ceasefire agreement with Israel. After 9 months of fighting in vain, the ceasefire put an end to the conflict. The Arabs did not accept the peace agreement with Israel because peace meant the recognition of the State of Israel. The Arabs accepted the ceasefire, not peace. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent. Suez Canal Company was owned by Britain for many years, but the new Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, gave a fervent speech on July the 26th, 1956, in Alexandria, announcing the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Then he raised the flag of his country in that region as the sign of this nationalization. All assets of Suez International Company, most of which belonged to Britain and France, were frozen. The French, who resented the Egyptian aid to the Algerian revolutionaries, in addition to the Suez affair, held a secret meeting in Paris with the British, who had been deprived of the huge Suez Canal shipping revenue. This top-secret meeting had a very special guest, Israeli representative Shimon Peres. The French and British believed that they had to inveigle Israel into invading Egypt in order to take revenge on Gamal Abdel Nasser. They knew that Nasser banned Israeli ships and planes from passing through the Strait of Tiran a year earlier in 1955, and this act could have provoked Israel to attack Egypt. Their ideas attracted Peres's attention, and he soon returned to Israel to inform David Ben-Gurion of their secret offer. Ben-Gurion began working on the plan and was sure that it could alleviate the situation. Nasser predicted the war and asked the United States to buy weapons. But Washington refused it because of the 1950 tripartite agreement on the Middle East among the US, France, and Britain. The agreement banned selling arms to countries in the region to prevent an arms race. So Gamal Abdel Nasser reached out to the Soviet Union for economic and military assistance. Czechoslovakia agreed to give arms to Egypt. The proximity of Egypt and the Eastern Bloc could have intensified the Cold War. On October the 29th, 1956, the Israelis invaded the Sinai Desert. A week later, they occupied it. French fighter jets also provided security for Israeli ground forces in Sinai against the powerful Egyptian Air Force. Israel ignored the importance of power. The United States, which was furious with Israel over its alliance with France and Britain, repeatedly pressured the United Nations Security Council to do something about a temporary ceasefire. On October the 13th, the UN Security Council convened and voted on a draft resolution urging Israel to withdraw its forces to establish a temporary ceasefire. But the resolution was vetoed by France and Britain, and the Soviet Union proposed a similar resolution that had no better fate than the previous one. Dwight D. Eisenhower, then President of the United States, appeared on camera and spoke on behalf of his nation.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities. I therefore have no plan to call the Congress in special session. Of course, we shall continue to keep in contact with congressional leaders of both parties. It is our hope and intent that this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem. In the past, the United Nations has proved able to find a way to end bloodshed. We believe it can and that it will do so again.
The dispute between the permanent members of the Security Council over the ceasefire was not resolved, and as a result, the UN General Assembly convened a special emergency meeting at the request of the Security Council and issued the ceasefire order by 57 votes. But France and Britain ignored the decree. When Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet Prime Minister, noted the situation of his communist ally, issued an ultimatum to France and Britain to destroy London and Paris with atomic bombs if they did not stop invading Egypt. The next day, the military offensive against Egypt ceased. On November the 14th, the first UN peacekeeping troops were deployed in the area, so the Israeli forces left Sinai. The UN flag established a 10-year ceasefire between Egypt and Israel. This fruitless retreat benefited Abdel Nasser more than anyone else. Nasser was about to become an irreplaceable hero of Arab dreams. In May 1967, when Egyptian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Anwar al-Sadat went to Moscow to meet the Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, he was secretly told that Israel had gathered all its forces on the Syrian border. A Anwar al-Sadat was asked to inform Abdel Nasser, the man who became the hero of the Arabs by nationalizing the Suez Canal. This mischievous news from the Russians was in fact a kind of incitement to provoke Egypt to attack Israel. The Soviet Union liked to witness a war in the Middle East, so the power in East and West would be in favor of the communists.
Мы думали, что в политическом плане, даже если война закончится в ничью,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
The Egyptian army did not report any movements on the Syrian-Israeli border, but the Russians again confirmed the news. In any case, Nasser did not take the risk and ordered his defense minister, Abdel Hakim Amer, to be ready to attack Israel if Israel invaded Syria. Russia's plan to start a war in the Middle East was turning into reality. Abdel Nasser wrote a letter to the United Nations calling for the withdrawal of peacekeeper troops stationed on the Israeli-Egyptian border since the nationalization of the Suez Canal, so that the Egyptian army could take stand. This measure drew all the attention to Sharm el-Sheikh port in Sinai. Egypt took the initiative and closed the Strait of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba again. By doing so, the Zionists' water connection with the east of the world was completely cut off. Egypt blocked the only way for Israeli oil transfer, and that meant the declaration of war.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
In the limelight.
A self-powered robot inspired by a fish can survive the extreme pressures at the bottom of the ocean's deepest trench thanks to its soft body and distributed electronic system, and might enable exploration of the uncharted ocean. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Cecilia Laschi Ryder. This article is published under the heading Soft Robot Reaches the Deepest Part of the Ocean. Stay tuned for more. Riding in nature, Lee et al. Report a robot made from soft materials that can brave the unexplored depth of the sea. Remarkably, the authors demonstrate that the robot can operate in the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. Conventional underwater vehicles require watertight enclosures made of metallic materials to withstand the high pressures of the deep ocean. The thickness and dimensions of these enclosures have to be increased to cope with greater depth. But in Lee and colleagues' robot, The delicate electronic components are embedded and distributed in soft silicon, a design that removes the need for pressure-resistant cases. Largely inspired by living organisms, the field of soft robotics involves making robots from pliable materials. Polymers such as silicon are often used, as well as highly deformable structures such as braids and textiles. Soft robots are intrinsically safer than their conventional rigid counterparts in interactions with humans, and their pliability can boost many capabilities, such as their dexterity when manipulating objectives, and their ability to squeeze into tight spaces or to travel across uneven surfaces. Marine species such as squid and octopus were one of the original inspirations for soft robotics research. But soft robotics in turn offers a new approach for tackling marine applications of robots. Lee and colleagues' work is a powerful demonstration of this. The author's robot is designed to have a fish-like body shape and two flapping side fins. The authors used a well-established mechanism to drive flapping. The fins are attached to muscles on the robot's body. These are made of a soft material that converts electrical energy into mechanical work. When an electric current from the robot's battery is applied to the